We'll call the meeting to order. We will not officially be in order because we do not have a quorum. The committee legislative assistant will note the roll and inform you when we have a quorum, and then we will officially come to order for today's meeting. We're going to be continuing the discussion from our last meeting with House Research, and Mr. Michael will lead us through some of those issues. You should have in your packet the PowerPoints. You should have those. And please do not be too concerned with my Cubs hat. You will see in a little bit how that plays into today's tax committee meeting. We're also going to, as promised, talk about the rules a bit when we have a quorum. And we will, at that point, then also be passing the minutes, but we don't have a quorum, so we will get going. As you know, we do start the tax committee meeting on time, all the time. So that being said, we'll turn it over to Mr. Michael. And Mr. Michael, there will be several times where we will be interrupting you just for some procedural issues. But members, we'll turn it over to Mr. Michael from House Research.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will go through the rest of the state taxes, which should take 5 to 10 minutes, and then Karen Baker and Steve Hines will switch gears and we'll move on to the property tax and local government aids and so forth. We left off with the motor vehicle license tax. This tax is applied to the base value of passenger motor vehicles that use the highway. And the base value is the manufacturer's value. There's a statutory depreciation schedule that reduces that. The tax, as time goes by, the tax rate is 1.25% of that value. After 11 years, that statutory depreciation schedule has worked its way down so that a $35 minimum applies. And the actual tax also includes a fee for handling and so forth that I think it's, you know, in the $40 range when you actually have the minimum dollar amount. This tax is deductible for federal and state tax purposes, but only the portion that's attributable to the base value, the percentage of value, the ad valorem part, so that $35 minimum and the additional fees are not deductible.
Mr. Michael, we will break in there. We do not have a quorum. I will officially call the tax committee to order. Representative Sertich would move the minutes from our previous meeting, from our first meeting. Any additions or corrections? Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question just looking at your first round of minutes here. And, you know, when we were in the majority, and I believe when the previous two tax chairs of your party were in the majority, this committee, some committee chairs choose to have three categories of attendance, which is present, excused, or absent. And I don't know that how you're doing it here because I don't see anyone marked absent, but in the past, we always tried to not have people get caught in this box where they're called absent. And so what we did is if people weren't there, we just said you're excused. Because, you know, we know we're all busy and people have multiple things to be at the same time. And I'm just wondering, is the intent for the minutes to show three categories or two?
Well, it'd be the intent basically to show two, but we would appreciate, that being said, we would appreciate folks, if they can't come, just let us know.
Thank you.
We're not going to play the game of, you know, you're absent 15 times from 11 committee meetings or something like that. So
thank you, Mr. Chair. I figured that with you, but yeah. just wanted to make sure.
But if members could, if you do have to be gone, just let us know. So for the record, we can just excuse you. It's just a lot easier that way.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
We'll go that way. And also, any further discussion on the minutes?
He wasn't here to read them.
No, I read them just now.
Right here.
Yeah, they're quite lengthy, but he's a speed reader, and he was Representative Sertich was able to get through them. So any further discussion on the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are passed. I've given a lot of time and thought to the rules discussion, and I want to be very clear to the committee that the rules that we were looking at were not in any way to stifle debate or slow down the minority or the majority. But what I've decided to do is, in the grand tradition of former chairs Lincheski, Representative Krinke, and Abrams and others, is and from the infamous Commerce Committee of old, that there will be no rules. The only rules that there will be mine. So that's so we do have rules,
Mr. Chair.
But Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we in the minority, we certainly appreciate that. And you know, we had you and I had a brief chance to talk before the last committee, and that has been the tradition bipartisanly. And folks know on the tax committee that this is where the tough people sit, because you vote on amendments as they come before you live. You don't have any prep, and because there haven't been any limits for 12 years, there have not been any rules about getting amendments in early or germaneness rulings or anything like that. So we definitely appreciate that you're going to treat us the way that we treated the now majority. So that really helps, and I think it starts us off to a great year. I do want to ask a question, though. It's not in rule, but there is the you had it in the rule originally about requests for per diem and expenses. And I just wanted to, you know, kind of hear your thoughts on this committee's budget and what your intention, you know, it's hard to know, but what you might think. We, just for some context, we were given a $25,000 budget in the 7-8 biennium. And we knew tough times were coming, so we spent about $7,000, and we returned the rest to the taxpayers. In the 9-10 year, we were given a budget of $18,000, and we spent $160. So we were very cognizant to not use resources that we didn't absolutely need. And I'm just wondering if you have been told by your speaker, do you have a budget for this committee, and then, you know, how do you intend to use it? We're just interested in just understanding that a little bit.
Yes, and thank you for that. I do not have any numbers from the lower corner. I'm on the fifth floor, so they're on the lower corner. When I refer to that, they're the lower corner. We have not seen any numbers yet, but we will use them appropriately for members of this committee if there needs to be travel to a forum or a conference or something that we feel would be beneficial to the committee. I think I'll break your record of $106 because if somebody needs to come down to a meeting and there's mileage and it needs to come out of the committee budget, we will use it for that. But I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. So I'm not even going to try and break that record. I'd go for 105, but can't do it. Representative Lincheski.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. Maybe we were the tight wads, but we didn't reimburse people for those expenses due to the deficit. So we kind of made people pay for it themselves. And so I am just, you know, it's something we'll be interested in kind of watching how that gets done. And I know that's controversial because it's part of people's, they view it as their compensation, but we chose not to compensate people. And we now with the deficit even larger, you know, we hope that you'll be cognizant of trying not to use any resources that aren't necessary.
And Representative Lincheski, as soon as we get word from the lower corner as to the amounts, I'll let you know.
Thank you.
Right away.
Appreciate it very much.
Right away. We'll do that. Okay, so the rules are there are no rules. And at this point in time, I would like to take Mr. Michael, just a moment for just a few comments on a member that will soon be leaving this body. And I feel very strongly that the House gets the short end of this stick. And the is it IRRB or what do you call yourselves now?
That's what it is.
Didn't they change it for a little bit?
It's back.
It's back. All right.
We found a missing arm.
You did? Okay.
Rukavina.
And I will say that the IRRB certainly is the winner in this situation here. And I just, Representative Sturge and I go back a ways, and there's two things that came to mind very quickly was a book that I had in my office given to me by Representative Rukavina many years ago, Shoeless Joe, that it has ties to the range and the 1919 Black Sox. Mm-hmm. Okay? Build it, and they will come. If you build it, he will come. Right there. And then also the one that gets me through my toughest days was a baseball card given to me by Representative Surge of the 1964 Chicago Cubs. Eighth place. So I am a huge Cubs fan. That goes way back. There's a long history there we won't get into today with Chicago. I mean, I love the Twins, but I love the Cubs too. My dream World Series would be the Cubs. And the Twins ended ending in a tie. Nobody'd win. You know, that'd be the way that would go. But that's the way that goes. So if you ever get down or depressed or anything like that, just get this card, because it just can't get any worse than them. if you think about it. So I really appreciate that. I do keep this card with me, and some very fond memories there. So I have just a bit of a presentation for you, Representative Sertich. First of all, notice the sleek design and the fine silk stitching. A Chicago Cubs hat. And legally, I checked with campaign finance. You can, if I give this to you on the premise that if you're in Preston, Minnesota during trout days, you have to walk in the parade with it, a vote for Greg hat.
Very nice.
This is a coveted hat, but it can only be used for campaign purposes. So if you're in Preston, stop over to the house and we'll give this to you. Or you can have it. Well, you can use it. Just make sure you bring it with you.
Bravo.
If you haven't been to my office yet, I am kind of short of hats.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sertich.
Mr. Chair, I thank you and appreciate it. Our friendship goes back quite a ways. You're one of my first chairs of committee when I first got here in the Commerce Committee, and enjoyed that time there. And our mutual liking of the Cubs, I like you, I'm a Cubs fan and a Twins fan. And actually, there's a chapter in that book, Shoeless Joe, and the book Shoeless Joe is where the movie Field of Dreams is based on, and there's one section of the book that wasn't made into the movie, and it's a great chapter, and it's called A Dying Cubs Fan's Last Request or Last Dream, and it's all about probably where the chair and I are gonna be long gone, and maybe the Cubs will still be long suffering, but just thinking about. The line from Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. I think instead of worrying about IRRB or IRRB or anything, that's going to be our motto. If you build it, they will come, and that's what we'll be working on up north. But I just appreciate your friendship, and thank you for this, and we'll see you in Preston in about a year and a half.
Sounds good. Thank
you. All righty.
Trout days in May. And you know, think about it. You know, I get criticized. I got my Cubs hats up in the office, and people say, aren't you a Twins fan? I say, yeah, I love the Twins. But why are you so intimidated by the Cubs? I mean, they've never hurt anybody. You know, just let it go. And my uncle, God rest his soul, from Villa Park, Illinois. That's how we got to go to Cubs games and so forth down at Wrigley Field. Well, I'll just tell you the story. And my cousins lived in Villa Park, and that's about 17 miles west of Chicago. And we would work mowing lawns. Of course, you couldn't go to night games because they didn't have lights at the time. And so we'd have a special day a couple times during that 2 weeks, and we'd get on the loop, and we'd go right down to the stadium. We'd go to the game, and it was a buck a ticket. We didn't have any money, so it was a buck a ticket. And then if you cleaned up afterwards, they give you a ticket for a future game. So that's huge. I can name the whole 69 team. But my uncle, I'll never forget him sitting in front of the TV cursing. And he'd finally calm down. He'd say, "Well, there's always next year." That's the motto for the Cubs. You gotta love them. Okay. With that being said, we will continue. And thank you, Representative Sertich, and best wishes to you, Mr. Michael.
Just to finish up on the motor vehicle license tax, the estimated revenues for fiscal 11 are $545 million, and of course those revenues go into the Highway User Trust Fund, which then gets allocated partially to the Trunk Highway Fund and partially to the local municipal state aid streets, county state aid streets, and so forth. The next tax is the Minnesota Care Tax. The tax base for this is the gross revenues of almost all health care providers. Tax rate's 2%. Some of the exceptions are Medicare and the federal employees' health programs are exempt because federal law doesn't allow us to tax them. Revenues are dedicated, they don't go to the general fund, but they go to the Health Care Access Fund, which is used to fund the Minnesota Care Program. Estimated revenues for 11 are $503 million. Next tax is the insurance premiums tax. The base for this tax is the gross premiums that are paid on insurance coverage. Most premiums are subject to a 2% tax rate, but there are lower rates that apply to some mutual companies. There are some mutual companies that are exempt, township mutuals. The larger mutuals pay at a 1.026 or something like 1.26, something like that. Fraternal benefit societies, in addition to the township mutuals, are exempt. Life insurance is subject to a 1.5% rate. Health maintenance organization and nonprofit health service plan corporations, that's the Blues, for those of you who aren't familiar with that terminology, pay a 1% tax. And that 1% tax on HMOs and the Blues goes into the healthcare access fund. One thing that's very important about the insurance premiums tax for legislating is that there's a retaliatory tax that applies. And the reason why this tax has a retaliatory tax is that, unlike all other taxes that the state imposes, there's a federal law that actually allows states, called the McCarran-Ferguson Act, that actually allows states in their insurance taxation to discriminate against interstate commerce. Normally you can't do that. You can't say we're going to tax out-of-state businesses more heavily than Minnesota businesses. But Congress has given us a pass, given states a pass on this, and that allows the retaliatory tax to be imposed. And basically what the retaliatory tax says is, if you tax our companies, our domiciled companies, more heavily, then we will tax your companies at the rate that you tax our companies. That's a little convoluted, but basically it means that if you have another state, you know, state XYZ imposes a 4% tax rather than Minnesota's 2% tax, then what we will do is, if a company from XYZ state sells insurance in Minnesota, the insurance they sell will not be subject to our regular 2% tax, but will be subject to the 4% tax. Now, the reason why this is very important is that almost all other states have a similar tax regime. And that means that if we raise our tax, then our companies, when they do business in these other states, if they have a lower tax, will pay at our higher rate. So in effect, by raising our tax on our companies here, on all insurance here, it effectively would raise the tax on our companies when they do business in these other states that actually have lower taxes than this new tax. And that's a real disincentive to raise taxes, and it's an incentive to cut taxes. That's one of the reasons why we have this lower 1.5% tax on life insurance, because a lot of other states have taxes that are not at 2%. So when we reduce our life insurance tax in Minnesota for our domiciled companies, that had the effect of also reducing their taxes in the other states where they do business that have lower rates than the 2%. So they got a tax cut not only from Minnesota, but from, Iowa is an example that has a lower rate. So when you're thinking about changes to the insurance premium tax, this retaliatory tax is an important element. The tax raised about $350 million, or is estimated to raise $350 million for fiscal 11. Some portions of this are dedicated to, as I indicated before, some go to Minnesota Care, and this is also the source for paying police and fire aid to cities and counties. The estate tax. Minnesota's estate tax is based on federal law rules, largely the federal rules that were in place in 2001, not the current rules. For many years, Minnesota had what's called a pickup tax, which basically was the amount that the federal government allowed a dollar-for-dollar credit against the federal estate tax. So in effect, when we had that and the federal government allowed it, they repealed that credit in the 2001 tax law. When that credit was in place, the estate tax really didn't increase Minnesota tax burdens, because if we had repealed that or didn't have that tax, their federal tax would have gone up by an equal amount. Well, Congress got rid of that, and we elected in 2001 to continue imposing our estate tax. The tax is now deductible in computing the federal estate tax, but the credit's gone. The way the tax is computed, it's based on the market value of the estate at the time of death. Transfers to surviving spouses are exempt. Charitable bequests are exempt, and there's a $1 million exemption. The tax rates range from 6.4% to 16%, almost almost all of the value is taxed at the 16% rate.
Representative Chesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael, on the estate tax, the new extended Bush tax cuts, what did Congress do on the estate tax? Did they also raise the amount? Will we have a bigger net loss?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, Congress made a number of important changes to the estate tax, some of which may have a revenue impact for Minnesota. The Department of Revenue is looking at that. It's not clear. There's a behavioral issue that's involved. The three important changes that Congress made was they increased the federal exemption amount from $3.5 million to $5 million. So the federal exemption amount is $5 million compared with the $1 million Minnesota exemption amount. They reduced the rate so that the federal rate now will be not 45% but 35%. In the old days it was scheduled to go back up to 55%. A third thing that they did is that they made the exemption portable. So under current law, in Minnesota and under old federal law, in order to make sure that when you had a married couple that you didn't lose the full benefit of the exemption when the first spouse died, you had to make sure that the first spouse who died owned enough property equal to the exemption, and then you had to put that money into a credit shelter trust or a family trust. There was a lot of, people sometimes did not do that, and so they would lose the benefit of that exemption. So, with a $5 million exemption for a married couple, you should be able to get $10 million because each spouse would get $5 million. The new federal law makes that portable so that, let's say the first spouse dies and only owns $2 million, there's still $3 million of the exemption left. What this new federal law allows you to do is that spouse can pass on to the survivor the benefit of that $3 million exemption. So when the second spouse dies, they get the $5 million exemption that they have and the $3 million that they sort of inherited from their spouse who died earlier. So that obviates the need to make sure that you have property distributed between the two spouses and that you have this two trust, credit shelter family trust and a marital trust arrangement. Now, none of that will affect Minnesota unless you decide to do something like that, because we're still operating under the old rules. But the fourth thing that Congress did, which could affect us, is that they raised the gift tax exemption from $1 million to $5 million. And the reason why that could affect our revenues is people who know they're going to die can avoid Minnesota estate tax by making what are sometimes called deathbed gifts. And it used to be because the federal gift tax kicked in at $1 million, just like the Minnesota exemption, there was a federal gift tax penalty for doing that. But now you can make a gift of up to $5 million, in contemplation of death, and it's not going to have that gift tax effect. And so that could, in fact, cause people who otherwise would not have done that, who have a terminal illness or something like that, to decide, hey, I can avoid the 16% Minnesota tax by transferring money right before I die. So, and the Revenue Department will have to look at that and make a judgment, and it could show up in the February forecast.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you.
We'll go to Representative Kiffmeyer in a second here, but Mr. Michael, by the feds putting the gift tax exemption up to $5 million, you can still only give away, what, $13,000? $100 per person, yeah. per spouse per person?
Yeah.
Correct. There are two kinds of exemptions, or there are at least two kinds of exemptions under there are multiple exemptions because charitable gifts are not taxable. But there are two separate kinds of exemptions. One is that there's this annual per person exemption, so you can give the $13,000, and that's just totally exempt. But you also have a lifetime exemption, which previously was $1 million, and is now $5 million.
Oh, okay.
So amounts that you give to an individual, let's say you give a person $100,000 in 1 year, the first $13,000 is exempt. The amount that's over that, the $87,000, is a taxable gift, but then you can use up your lifetime exemption of $5 million now and not pay tax on it. So you always have to keep in mind that there are those two exemptions, and that's that second one that could affect, you know, this sort of deathbed gift avoidance of Minnesota estate tax.
Representative Giffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And remembering that, of course, all those monies were taxed at one point along the way in regards to some of these inheritance things. But I think the question I have is, I know many of these other tax changes were a year or two. So on the portability and on the $5 million, is that a policy that goes forward, or does it have a sunset?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, that's a very important point. This does not, this again, like all of that extension, almost all of that extension legislation is a two-year provision, including the portability provisions. So we'll, you know, face 2 years from now the same issue. And so it would revert back in after that two-year period to the $1 million exemption, the 55% tax rate, non-portability, et cetera.
Representative Kiffmeyer? Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'll just make a comment, and if Mr. Michael wants to respond, but this is a highly volatile tax, and it sounds like we don't really understand yet, until revenue does its work, what the impact will be on the forecast. But you mentioned something about behavior driving the potential implications for revenue in the next biennium from the estate tax, and I know we are only able to do static modeling on these taxes, and so maybe just a placeholder for us when we come back and start looking at the forecast, if you could either comment now or then about whether or not these potential behavior changes that you might anticipate, the more dynamic modeling, would tell us whether estate tax revenues would logically be expected to go up or down from our forecast. I'm just concerned that we might be missing a $50 to $100 million revenue opportunity or loss based on behavior changes. So anyway, if you have a comment now, great. Otherwise, I just want to make sure we come back to that when we review the forecast.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, I think, you know, Paul Wilson's probably the better one to talk about static versus dynamic estimates. The department, though, something like this is a secondary effect that doesn't sort of fit into the dynamic modeling. If they have good reason to believe that there will be a behavioral change, if they have good evidence for that, they will take that into account. Now, this is one of those things where they probably don't have any evidence because they don't really know how people are going to react to this. And so I'm sure they're sort of scratching their heads saying, should we do something or not? But it's sort of, I mean, another example is if you propose to raise the cigarette tax rate, for example, they have done studies and they know that for given tax rate changes, and they're have been very close in the past in estimating this, that they know that, you know, some people will stop smoking, some people will start buying cigarettes across the border and so forth, and so they try to take into account those kinds of behavioral changes. So, and this could fall into that category if they have reason to believe. And I would guess that they might talk to practitioners, to estate planners, and to try to make a judgment as to what kind of behavior might occur from this. And we're not talking about big, probably very big numbers, at least in the short run.
Representative Downey? Mr. Michael?
Yes, Representative Downey made the point that, first of all, it's the current projection is about $154 million for the current year from this tax. It is important, as Representative Downey pointed out, to recognize that this is an incredibly volatile tax. It's probably our most volatile tax. And the slide shows in 1 year we collected $216 million, and another year in the last, you know, with 5 years later, $54 million. And that year when we collected $216 million, if I recall right, there was one estate that paid $115 million or something like that. It's sort of become the norm that states do not have estate inheritance taxes. 29 states do not. If you look in the bigger handout, there's a map, and you can see which ones do and don't. And there is this issue about, does it change people's domicile decisions? Do people actually move to a state without an estate tax so that they can avoid this tax? Because it can be, you know, very substantial. Turning to the mortgage registry tax, and then I'll quickly finish up with this. This tax is imposed on mortgages that, based on the principal amount of the loan secured by real property in the state. The tax rate's 0.23%. It's collected by the bank at closing, paid to the county treasurer. State gets 97% of the revenue, the county 3%. Obviously, the mortgage meltdown and the slowdown in the, you know, in the real estate market has really hurt revenues under this. The current revenue projections, $80 million. We used to collect $125-150 million. Last tax I'll talk about is the deed transfer tax, which is sort of a companion to the mortgage tax. This is imposed when you transfer properties, and it's based at has a rate of 0.33% of the consideration. It's paid by the person who actually transfers the property. Distribution is the same as the mortgage registry tax, 97% to the state. County keeps 3% for administration. Revenue is projected for 11 or $45 million. With that, I'll stop and have Steve and Karen take over and talk to you about property taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Michael.
Any
questions for Mr. Michael? Representative Runbeck.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Michael, could you comment on our capital gains situation, the taxes there? I mean, we don't hear about it in this presentation. Is that because it's just considered an income tax and so on? But, I mean, other states treat it differently than we do. It's another one that's very volatile. I don't know what kind of numbers, if you break it out in your income picture. But it seems like it's worth talking about and understanding a little bit.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, yes, the Minnesota capital gain tax is just a feature of our individual income tax. And unlike the federal government, Minnesota taxes capital gains on the same basis as ordinary income. So your net amount of capital gains, whether it's short-term or long-term, will be taxed at the regular income tax rates ranging from 5.35 up to 7.85. And yes, it is a very volatile source, as you would expect when the stock market melts down as it did back in 2008. The revenues from the tax, you know, essentially dropped precipitously. And in the boom years of the 90s, that was some of the explanation for why we were getting, as the then Commissioner of Finance referred to it, as boatloads of revenue. And so it does present, you know, financial management problems. There are some states, and we have a short subject on our website that, you know, describes how other states tax capital gains. Minnesota's way of taxing them is probably the most common way that they are taxed. But there are some states, like our neighboring state Wisconsin, that have an exclusion for a part of long-term capital gains, and there are some states that have, you know, special exemptions. As you would expect, capital gain on farmland sales in Iowa gets a preference. Condominium developers in Hawaii get a break. Ranchers in Idaho get breaks. You know, so there are all sorts of those kinds of things, and there are some states that just, you know, like have 50% exclusions and so forth. But the norm is the way Minnesota taxes it.
Representative Runbeck.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Michael. Any other questions for Mr. Michael? Thank you, Mr. Michael. We'll now move to property taxes. And members, this is the last day for overviews. We start bills next Tuesday. Not that these aren't just barrels of fun, but we will start hearing bills. And members, if we have some days, we don't have a whole lot of bills so far, and that's fine. But we're not just going to have meetings. So just stay tuned to your emails if we're having the meeting or not. We will be meeting this next Tuesday for sure. Okay, please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Catherine Schill, and I'm the fiscal analyst, one of the fiscal analysts for this committee and for Property Tax Division. I'm the lead-off with the presentation to you for the overview of property taxes. You've got two documents for reference. One is the PowerPoint. It looks like this. It's 20 pages long with 40 slides. The second document is a collection of reference materials. It's short subjects. It looks like this, and it'll give you more detail on some of the issues that we will be reviewing. You do have a third document that I'm not going to go over today, but it's meant for reference. It's entitled Selected Slides from Presentation to Minnesota's Property Tax Working Group. It's got a shaded area for the title page. And it basically discusses property tax systems in general and then some attributes of Minnesota's property tax system. If you're familiar with the Minnesota Property Tax Working Group, there is a meeting scheduled for tomorrow at 10:30 in the state capitol, and that group has been meeting regularly, almost on a monthly basis, since the end of the summer. And they'll be reviewing the classification system, and it's a good primer if you're not familiar with our property tax classification system. It's a good primer on issues including things like green acres and other things that will potentially be of topic matter for this committee. In general, in Minnesota, the governance of property taxes is a shared responsibility between the state and local governments. While property taxes are the mainstay of local government finances, Minnesota's property tax system is highly centralized at the state level. State law controls a number of the system features, which both House Research colleagues and I will discuss. I will go over the overview of state and local taxes and spending on property tax relief programs. Ms. Baker, to my left, will do the property tax administration, things like truth in taxation, limited market value, and property class rate. Property class rates, mining, and property tax refunds. Mr. Hines will cover things like property tax rates, the statewide property tax, county program aid, and attributes of the market value credit features, both homestead and agriculture, school district levies, and fiscal disparities. And Ms. Dalton will go over things like local government aid and levy limits. We'll start on slide two that has state and local taxes. Combining all state and local taxes in Minnesota, fiscal 2011 tax revenues are expected to reach $25.2 billion. As shown by the pie chart on slide two, property taxes bring in the most revenues, yielding $8.1 billion, or about 32% of the total. Next are individual income taxes with almost $7.3 billion, or about 29%. Statewide sales taxes are third with $5.3 billion, or about 21%, and other taxes, including corporate franchise gas tax and excise taxes, at $4 billion, or about 16%. Of this $25.2 billion in tax collections, the split between state and local tax revenues is about $17.4 billion to $7.8 billion, or about 2.2 to 1. Moving to slide three, which is a 10-year comparison of the big three: income, sales, and property taxes. This overall chart gives a 10-year comparison for fiscal years 2001, 2006, and 2011. Note how the sales tax grew from fiscal 01 to 06 and then declined slightly in fiscal 11, that the income tax dipped slightly between fiscal 01 and 06, but then rebounded in fiscal 11, and that the property tax slide shows little change between 01 and 06, and then it spiked in fiscal 11. Of the $25.2 billion in state and local taxes, they accounted for 82.2 of the total. In fiscal 01, these three big taxes accounted for approximately 85% of the total in state and local collections. I will turn to Ms. Baker.
For the record, my name is Karen Baker, House Research. Moving on to slide 4, that flow chart just gives a overview of who does what in the property tax system. I'm going to move fairly quickly, but you can see there's several different players, the assessor, the auditor, the treasurer, and I would point out that in many counties, a lot of these functions have been merged into property tax offices, and so you don't always have each of those functions separately, but counties are responsible for property tax administration, and the Department of Revenue provides assistance and oversight. The assessor's office values property, determines classification, sends valuation notices out. Auditors are the ones that are determining the proposed and final tax rates and preparing truth and taxation notices, and treasurers are doing the property tax statements and sending out payments and doing tax distributions. Let's move on to the property tax timeline. I think that's something which, and I think the easiest thing is if you look at page 7 of the overview rather than on the, that gives you a very good kind of highlights of, if you look on page 7, you'll see that the a single property tax cycle spans more than 2 calendar years. And if you look on the left-hand side, you can see that 2010, you can see how the assessment date starts in January, valuation notices are mailed in March, and then you can follow that schedule down local boards of appeal and equalization, and then certification of state aid amounts, the truth in taxation levies, and then final budget hearings, and then in January, county auditors compute the tax rates and statements are mailed in March, and then by May, the first half payments are due, and in July, the first half state aid payments are made, and in October, the second half payments are due, except in the case of ag payments, and they're not due till November, and then in December, the state aid payments are made. So you can see that there's really a whole two-year cycle here. And if you kind of look on the right-hand side, while that's going on, the other the property tax cycle is occurring again. And so I think that gives you a flavor for just how long a property tax cycle really takes. Moving on then, let's go to the next slide in truth and taxation. Truth in taxation really dates way back to 1988, and really there really haven't been a lot of changes that have occurred in truth in taxation, a lot of minor kind of things, up until just a couple years ago when the legislature did away with the newspaper advertisements that disclosed. We used to have newspaper advertisements where the proposed levy and spending amounts were actually published in the newspaper, and there was a separate public hearing, and both of those were eliminated, and now the only thing that's left with truth in taxation is the actual notices, and those notices show each taxpayer's tax burden, what those levies are going to be. It's a proposed notice that comes out, and really what the attempt of that is to show taxpayers information of what that proposed tax is going to be prior to the final levies, to give them some chance to attend hearings and attend city council meetings, attend school board meetings, and attend county board hearings, to convince or persuade their local budget people if, in fact, they feel that those levies are too high, and discuss those levies with them. So moving on then to the next slide, page 7, the property tax terms. There are several property tax terms we've chosen. These are just the primary ones that are needed, and Steve's going to talk later on about class rates, but the county assessor determines each property's taxable market value. Taxable market value is basically the same term as estimated market value. When the assessor goes out and determines your estimated market value, that is, in most cases, the same as taxable market value, except for a couple different... And I hate to mention the term Green Acres, but if you happen to be in a Green Acres program, those two would be different. But in most cases, the estimated and taxable are the same. But then you take class rates times the taxable market value, and you get net tax capacity. And each local taxing district then sets its tax levy, and levy divided by total net tax capacity equals the jurisdiction's tax rate. And then gross tax...
Excuse me, Ms. Baker. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Baker. could you just address the issue now of foreclosures and how the, you know, each county, are they treating it the same way in terms of their overall valuation numbers? I mean, I'm reading that Minneapolis doesn't. Is not including the foreclosed properties in their estimate, apparently. But maybe you know more about that. Could comment.
Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, I believe what you're talking about is whether or not the foreclosures, when they're looking at those values in their sales, in their sales ratio in determining sales. Yeah. I presume that that's what you're talking about. And, you know, I think that's an issue which is a fairly complex issue that probably needs some discussion in property committee as to how they really handle foreclosures that I really can't deal with just right now. You know, I think what we need to do is get assessors up here on how they're dealing with foreclosures.
Okay. Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please continue, Ms. Baker. And to the committee, if if I don't, you folks have done a lot of work on this, and so if we do have a little overflow into Tuesday to finish up, don't worry about that. We will do what we need to do there. So, Ms.
Yeah.
Baker.
Yeah. I might say on page 9 of the actual overview, or the overview that we've given you, there are a lot more property tax terms, and the couple terms that we have in our slides are just kind of some key ones that we've actually picked out. But the property taxes gross tax is just its net tax capacity times the tax rate of all the taxing jurisdictions. And the only difference between a property's gross tax and net tax is if it happens to have some credit applied to it. Like, for instance, if it happens to be a residential piece of property that has a homestead, a market value homestead, market value homestead credit, then it would have a net property tax. Otherwise, it's going to have the gross tax and the net tax are going to be the same. So with that, Steve is going to go into the various class rates that are against the property.
Mr. Hines, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Steve Hines from the House Research Department. I will pick it up from there. And as most of you, I'm sure, are aware, Minnesota has what we call a classified property tax system. Different classes of property or different types of property have a different class rate assigned to them, which gives us allows property of different types to be taxed at a different amount, even if it's the same value. This slide here is showing you the class rates for probably the most common types of property we have. We see the lowest rate we have is the ag homestead class rate. For the first $1.14 million of an ag homestead, and this $1.14 million is an index number that changes each year, that's a class rate of 0.5%. Then the next common one we have is the residential homestead, which you see is 1A, at least 1% for all the value under 500,000. So basically we think of those as a 1% rate for residential homes and a 0.5% for ag homesteads. And then commercial industrial at the bottom of the slide is the other major one that gets talked about all the time, and that it has our highest rate of 2% on the value over 150,000 a slightly lower rate of 1.5% for any value under $150,000. The next slide picks up a few other property types, mostly the residential non-homestead properties. Apartments are at 1.25%. Single unit res non-homestead is the same as residential homestead at 1% for the most part. Duplexes and triplexes, the class 4B, 1.25%, and then seasonal recreational, another class that gets some discussion in these parts, is that also at 1% on the first 500,000. So this class rate schedule that's sort of now in effect has largely been left intact since a major overhaul in 2001. Prior to that, these rates fluctuated much more often with legislative whims and characteristics of property values, but they've been very constant over this past decade. The way these class rates play out is this next slide shows the comparison of if you had the same a property valued at $200,000 in the same jurisdictions, what the actual net tax would be because of the different classification rates and also the credit structure. And so you can see that the if the 200,000 property happened to be an agricultural homestead, its net tax amount would only be $790 under the assumed rates we're using here. Whereas for homestead, it would be $2168, seasonal rec, similarly at $2293, and finally a commercial industrial property of $200,000 would have a tax of $5,170. Frequently, a term we'll hear in the discussion of property tax is the effective tax rate, and that simply is the ratio of the net tax to the market value in the last column. So you can see that the ag homestead rate is 0.39% effective rate, and the commercial industrial is at 2.59. That's a common way to compare tax burdens across different types of property.
Excuse me, Mr. Hines, Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Hines, just curious on that slide up there now on the seasonal recreational, does it include the statewide education tax in that?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, yes, this does include the seasonal rec, or the statewide tax for both the seasonal rec property and the commercial industrial property.
Representative Rukavina?
No.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, the next slide now shows the statewide distribution of the market value by type of property and the tax by type of property. And this is one where the slide on the overhead you can probably see easier than the one in your handout because it's using the colors. In the longer handout, that you can also get this information. But what the main thing it shows is that the you have, especially if you look at ag homestead or agricultural property, you'll notice that the pie for them is 16% at market value, but they only pay 7% of the total tax in the state. So they're the most favored class, as evidenced by the lowest class rate of the 0.5%. Homes similarly comprise 53% of the market value in the state, pay 44% of the total taxes in the state. The one that goes the other direction the most notably is commercial industrial, which is 13% of the market value in the state, but pays 31% of the total property tax. And this is the results of the classification system and to a lesser extent, the credit structure that we've talked about a little bit already. The next slide now is taking us into where does that money go? So the first part dealt with where it sort of comes from. Now where does it go? And for calendar year 2010, we raised approximately just a little bit under $8 billion in property taxes statewide. As you can see from this chart, just a little under a third is paid to counties. Cities and school districts each account for about a quarter of the total. The state is about 10%, and then townships and special taxing districts make up the rest. Now kind of getting into a little bit of the different types of jurisdictions, the next slide is talking about school district levies, and this is, we don't go into that very much in this committee, but it's good for us to have some awareness, I think, of what's how things work in the school district world. And this slide is trying to show a number of different things. First of all, if you look at the dark versus the white shaded areas, the dark shaded are the voter approved levies and the white shaded are the ones that are not voter approved, and you can see about 60% of school levies are actually voter approved, and that's the referendum levies or the bonded for operating referendums or for bonded debt. Another sort of way to look at how the school levies are split is the cross-hatched ones, which are the ones that are spread on referendum market value as opposed to the normal tax base that based on the classification rates. And again, there it's about 37% or so is referendum market value based. And we haven't said anything about referendum market value levies up to now or that tax base, but that is the part of the tax base that's not does not use the classification system. So levies against the referendum market value tax base, $1,000 of homestead value pays the same tax as $1,000 of commercial industrial value. So that's kind of a unique aspect of that referendum market value tax. And approximately, like I said, 40% of school taxes are spread on that alternative tax base. One other sort of cut you could make of this is that it also splits about 50-50 between operating and capital levies. If you look at the categories kind of at the top and the left, the operating referendum, equity and transition, and other operating, those are the operating levies, and that's almost exactly half versus the voter-approved debt, the board-approved debt, and other capital. So interesting other way of breaking down the school levies. The state tax, we're just going to say a little bit about that. It's $800 million almost exactly for calendar year 11, and that has an annual inflator on it, so it goes up by approximately the CPI each year. The only classes of property that pay the state general tax are commercial, industrial, and seasonal recreational, as Representative Rukavina alluded to, and since 2006, those shares are fixed, so that 95% of the state general levy falls on commercial industrial and 5% on seasonal recreation. And I think Michelle is now going to talk about the major property tax relief programs.
Michelle? Yeah, thank you, Mr. Heinz.
The next two slide members provide a quick summary of selected tax relief programs, identifying who benefits and how much is forecasted for fiscal 2012. Of all tax and aid credit spending, the top four programs, which include local government aid, county program aid, market value credit, both kinds, and property tax refunds for both homeowners and renters, comprise $1.5 billion, or 87% of the $1.7 billion in the anticipated fiscal 2012 budget. Now you can take a look at the first slide contains the aids, has specific numbers, $527 million for LGA, $198 for CPA, and each of the school-related kinds of aids are significantly less. Moving to the next slide, we have both credits and refunds identified, $265 million for the homestead market value credit. That goes to jurisdictions. The agricultural market value credit is significantly less than that. And then the refunds, property tax refunds for homeowners totals $318 million. Those refunds provided directly to individuals. Then the renter property tax refund, $200 million. And then what we call targeting or special property tax refunds, significantly less. And now I believe it's Ms. Dalton will provide some spending history with respect to tax aids and credits for cities and counties.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. Fortunately, for the way these were printed off, you can actually look at two slides at once, and I think that will be really useful for you. So the first two slides I'm going to actually talk about in tandem are the slide about city LGA and the city market value credits. Of course, one of the things you hear about a lot is that we certify aids and credits. We tell people, local governments, that we're going to pay them, and then we don't actually pay the full amount. So these slides actually show you what had been certified and then what was actually paid in each of the years. Now, one thing that should be noted is there is a difference to what we can do with market value credits and what we can do with the aid programs. The aid programs we certify, they have appropriations and then they have formulas that distribute them. So in a year that they've already been certified, we do the cut after the certification. So for instance, if you wanted to cut paid 2011 aids, they already have a number that they've been planning on, the local governments. So you would have to basically, if you wanted to cut their aids for fiscal 12, which is pay 2011, this year, you actually have to cut what you already certified. If it's going to be in a future year, you can actually reduce the appropriation. And that's what this LGA slide shows. If you notice, in 2003, that cut was made post-certification, but for 2004 and 2005, the cut was basically made by reducing the appropriation level for those years during the 2003 session.
So, Chair. Representative Paymar.
So maybe this, Mr. Chair, maybe this is just self-explanatory then. So if I look at that slide and the slide three, the spike in property taxes, that would be, I guess the question is that a direct correlation to the increase in to the cuts in LGA and county aid?
Ms. Dalton?
Just sort of glossed over that slide like it was without any explanation. It would be nice to hear nonpartisan staff give an explanation.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a correlation. It is not necessarily a perfect correlation. Some of it is due to administration, having to do with how we calculate levy limits. And some of it is due to individual decisions on the local government, by individual local governments. For modeling purposes, the researchers who are modeling this generally assume that for every dollar of aid lost, we're assuming roughly a two-thirds of it gets levied back and one-third of it is either spending reductions or use of other revenue sources. Is that a perfect science? No. But it's our best guess of what is going on at this point. And there was some indication looking at what happened in, I'm looking at the Department of Revenue Researcher, 2010, that there was, at least at a statewide level, that wasn't an unreasonable assumption.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I think one thing that, you know, I just throw out there that there, it's not going to show up on any graph, any bar graph, is there, in addition to cities and counties who certify something and then go down when the state doesn't do what it says it's going to do, and I'm thinking now of market value homestead credit for maybe new legislators. You know, there's a lot of us who don't receive local government aid, but everybody gets market value homestead credit. And the state has not paid market value homestead credit to cities basically forever. So it's been a number of years now that the state keeps not doing that. That leaves the local elected officials on the hook because the resident gets the benefit, but the city council has to choose to either cut services or, you know, raise taxes. So they're kind of left with the final deal here. And I think what doesn't show up on these bar graphs that would be just interesting to think about is this is kind of a debate between certification and what's paid. And what also is going on is a whole bunch of cities are not even certifying anything because they're assuming they'll never get paid. So, for example, in the city of Bloomington, there's been three rounds now where the city council has said, we're just going to assume they'll never pay us. And so they're not even starting with a certification number and then not being reimbursed. So if there was a way to factor that in, which you really can't do, I think you'd see the net impacts of property tax increases are really profound. That just doesn't show up here. And I think a lot of city councils have been doing that and just choosing to know that the state isn't going to honor its commitments.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Chair. I really don't have any comment.
Any other questions on this issue? Otherwise, we'll proceed. Representative Bills?
Yeah, I do have to ask. I just came off the city council in Rosemount there, and I don't remember us getting homestead market value credit, and I just want to make sure if I'm correct, or maybe I missed something for the years that I was there. Did we in Rosemount receive that credit?
Yes.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's actually a really good segue into the slide on the city market value credit.
Yes.
Aid and credit cuts are normally made from aids first, and then if a city or county has little or no aid, so it's all wiped out by the cut, then we take it out of their market value credit payment. And those, because of how market value credit is calculated, we can't change an appropriation. There's only an open and standing appropriation. So those cuts carry forward, and as you notice, in 2007 is the only year in the last since 2003 that we have actually paid the certified market value credit amounts to all cities. Cities who have enough aid to take all the cut out of their LGA do not see a reduction in their market value credit. The people who have been seeing the reductions in their market value credit are the cities who get no LGA, and so then we pretty much wipe out their market value credit payment as well.
Representative Bills?
Apologies. Mr. Chair, and that was us for Rosemount, then. We had no LGA.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that's correct.
Okay. Representative Bills?
Thanks, sir.
Mr. Chair, just for clarity, maybe one way to think about it is on the City Council, and Representative Bills, I haven't met you yet. Nice to meet you. The market value homestead credit, often even in the council, unless they're affected by it directly, they're not even aware of it because it shows up on the homeowner's statement before the final pay line. So if you go back and read your property tax statement, they're already getting the minus market value credit benefit for that individual, but you as the city council member is not. So you're stuck with the bottom line solution, and the resident is kind of oblivious to what's going on in the system unless they really comb their statement. So.
And that would explain.
Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Lewin, I'm going to practice. Lewinchesky.
We'll all learn. Lewinchesky.
Thank you. I apologize for my wickedly easy name. So.
Lewinchesky, was your maiden name Smith or something?
This is my main name, actually. My husband's name is Erickson.
You might want to reconsider.
Would have made it easier.
Okay. Where am I? Representative Bills.
But thank you, Representative. That would explain why some of our residents were upset at us. So.
Representative Lincheski? Okay, thank then you. Representative Garofalo, and then run back. Representative Garofalo?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and for staff or for Representative Erickson Lincheski, the 12-13 forecast are the reductions in the market value homestead credit that took place in 10 and 11, are those the forecast for 12 and 13? Do we automatically extend those, or are those snapping back in 12 and 13 for the market value homestead credit portion?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, there were two sets of cuts made in pay 2010. Part of it was related to the governor's unallotment that was ratified. And then there was a second cut. First cut was about $200 million. Second cut was about $100 million. The market value credit cuts related to the first part of the cut were made permanent. The market value credit cuts related to the second part were not made permanent.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, there's something else that's a little interesting about what happened in 2010. In 2010, the first part of the cuts were made in the traditional fashion of taking it first from aids and second from credits. The second half of it was taken in the opposite direction. It was taken first from everyone's market value credit, and then if we wiped out their market value, remaining market value credit, then it was taken from aids. And that is why you see on the city market value credit cut the really deep cut in 2010, because most of that second cut was taken out of all cities' market value credit aids, but only the part that was came out of market value credit aids in the first part of the cut was made permanent, and that's why the cut in 2011 is much smaller.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to sort of echo what Senator or Representative Lencheski is saying. And, you know, my couple of my cities have already pretty much accepted the reality that market value homestead credit is just something they're not going to be able to count on. I think it sort of suggests that this system, given where we're at in terms of revenues and so on, is beginning to kind of unravel. And I think we do need, you know, in this time frame to think about just which pieces of it and so on really need true reform. Because cities aren't, you know, they're accepting the reality and budgeting around it and without it.
Representative Mark.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Runbeck. One thing, and when you try to just pick one area out of the property tax system, it's all linked everywhere else. So like market value homestead credit, about 58% goes out to rural Minnesota. Where you take a property tax refund portion, 72% go to the metro area. So that's why I think we all agree probably in property taxes we're going to look at market value homestead credit this year. I mean, it is a system that it doesn't work the best, but you just can't take it out of there because it affects one area of the state more than another or other things. And they all actually play into kind of a balancing act. And so that's why and you hear from citizens sometimes, how come you do this or that? But it's all related to other areas of aids and credits and refunds that have a balancing act throughout the state that kind of serves things. So I know when we get into property tax division, we'll talk about that a little bit more.
Ms. Dalton?
The next set of two slides are on the county program aid and the county market value credit. As you notice, the county program aids are cut on the same years that the city LGA was. You notice there are very, very few county market value credit cuts over the years. That is because all counties get county program aid, CPA, and there's normally been enough of that to cover all of their costs. The cut that you see in 2010 is, as I said, that second phase of the 2010 cuts that were made first for market value credits and then from aids if necessary. And as you notice, because only the market value credit cuts from the first phase of the 2010 cuts were made permanent, counties' market value credits go back up in 2011. We normally make, when aid and credit cuts are made, they tend to focus on cities and counties, but occasionally cuts are made to townships and special taxing districts. In the 2009 and 10 cuts were made to township market value credit, and that's what you're seeing reflected here, and those cuts are made permanent going into the future. So with that, we'll do a hopefully incredibly brief overview of local government aid. That is a city aid program only. As I said, it's the amount paid in 2008 through 2010 has been less than the amount certified to the local governments when they've been setting their budgets. Prior to the 2010 session, the LGA appropriation for 2011 and future years was scheduled to be $558 million, part of that through an inflation factor that was in place for 3 years. In last year's session, this amount was reduced to $527 million, which is $9 million less than what was originally certified for 2010. LGA is distributed, most of it is distributed on a formula based on paying a percent of unmet need. And unmet need is equal to need, each city's need minus its ability to pay. Need is basically measured based on a number of factors that are outside the control of cities. There's a lot more detail on this in a short subject, which is included on pages 21 and 22 of your overview. But basically, the factors have to do with population and how much commercial and industrial property. And as Representative Rukavina likes to point out, there is an accident rate factor in there for larger cities.
I tried, Mr. Chair.
Chairman Rukavina.
I tried to set up a program in one of my cities where people could smash their car into with something and then we get more aid, but then I found out it had to be documented by the sheriffs or police and that. So
That didn't work out, but it made as much sense as the formula itself.
Thank you, Ms. Dahl, for bringing that up. We really appreciate that. Ms. Dalton.
The measure of ability to raise, ability to pay has really been an ability to raise tax revenue, and it's based on the city's tax capacity or tax base times an average city tax rate. In pay 2011, certified aides are based on paying 79% of that unmet need, or the difference between need minus ability to pay. If unmet need is negative, the ability to raise local revenues is higher than the need that the formula matches, there are some additional small pots of money going to small city aid and going to some city jobs-based aid. Those amounts get reduced. And then there's caps on annual increases and decreases. In 2008, there were a number of changes.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Dalton. Just on that slide, we've had some cities, say St. Cloud, which has seen tremendous growth over the last 20 years. So I would expect then that their need has declined. Would that be true, and they're getting far less LGA?
Ms. Dalton?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck.
Both of them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, yes, there are certainly factors that tend to reward cities that are losing population rather than gaining population, but it's the change in all of those factors that determine need. I'd actually have to go back and take a look at St. Cloud and see where they fall. But two factors that tend to not be to the advantage of growing cities is percentage of housing built before 1940 and the population decline factor. But I think that's only in small cities.
Representative Runbeck.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair. It would be good to take a look at that, I think.
Please proceed, Ms. Dalton.
As I said, there were a number of changes, minor changes made to the formula in 2008, basically to address some volatility issues that have been raised by the cities, and also to direct some money to some inner ring suburbs. It has to do with, most of the changes have to do with, there's caps on maximum and minimum increases and decreases to individual cities. I suggest looking at the overview, and we won't go into all that detail.
Mr. Chairman, I'm back up on county program aid, I guess.
Mr. Hines.
Thank you. County program aid is a program that was created in 2004, or 2003. The first year was 2004. And it is kind of a poor cousin to local government aid, which is quite a bit bigger program and has been around for a much longer time. There was a desire to possibly put counties on the same basis. Prior to that time, counties received a number of different kinds of general purpose aids, but they were a little bit more oriented towards specific needs. The programs now are listed on that slide, HACA, which is now getting to be far enough in the past that maybe people have forgotten what HACA was, but that was a residual program from a previous credit program, actually, that everybody got some of. There was a program called Attached Machinery Aid, a very old program, very small. CCJA, County Criminal Justice Aid, Family FPA, Family Preservation Aid. So those four programs were combined in the 2003 session to form this new county program aid, which was kind of this corollary to local government aid, but for counties. The formula then really didn't kick in until 2005. And the formula has two parts. Half the money basically goes out under each of the two different formulas. One is based on county's need, and one is based on tax-based equalization. I'll get into those in a little bit more detail next. As with LGA, in 2008, 9, and 10, counties did not receive the amount that they had been told they would get, that they were certified, because the state had to come in and make cuts due to budgetary situation. The need part of county program aid is based on three factors. Basically, it says county age index. It's really a population index with some components for senior citizens get counted more heavily in the population, but it's a weighted population index. A crime index and then a number of households on food stamps. On page 25 of the longer overview document has a more detailed explanation of the county program aid formulas. The tax-based equalization aid looks only at two things, the size of the county's tax base and its population. And as I said, through the history, those two formulas have had equal weights in determining county shares of program aid. All counties get something under the county program aid program, unlike LGA, where many cities don't get anything. Then the next two things, we've talked plenty about market value credit already, but more in terms of the aggregate dollars, just to kind of make it clear or how the actual amounts of homestead market value credit are computed. The table on the chart and the and page probably about 28 or so in the overview shows that basically it's a kind of an unusual program in that the most amount you get of market value credit occurs at a very low value. A $75,000 home gets $300. A home that's less than $75,000 gets less than $300, and a home that's greater than $76,000 is really where the peak occurs, gets less than $300. So if you happen to be sitting right at $76,000, you're getting the most you could get out of that program. But it declines very gradually as values increase, as you can see from the table. A $200,000 home gets $190. A $300,000 home gets $100. At $400,000, it's basically gone. And this program has been very constant. It was part of that 2001 reform I mentioned earlier. And this program has stayed the same ever since in terms of how you actually compute the credit. For a long time, the amount of that credit had been declining as home values increased over the decade. Now, in this last couple of years of the economic downfall, economic downturn we've seen, where home values have actually been declining, it's gone the other way, and now the market value credit is actually costing the state a little bit more each year, to the extent that the state doesn't cut the payments, which is the story we've heard already. Agricultural market value credit has some similarities. The most value you can get in the home and the ag credit occurs at $115,000 of value, where you can get $345. It goes down a little bit as your value increases after that. $350,000 is where it reaches $230, and basically any farm valued $350,000 or more gets a flat $230. That cost of this program is very steady at about $24 or $25 million each year. And I think Karen is now going to take over on property tax refund.
Okay, moving on to slide 33, the property tax refund. This is a program which provides property tax relief to homeowners and renters whose property taxes are high relative to their income. If property tax exceeds a threshold percentage of income, refund equals a percentage of the tax over the threshold up to the maximum. You can see on the table the property tax refund for refunds filed in 2009, which is the latest data that we've got, that the state paid out about $450 million. And you can see that senior and disabled homeowners, it was about 140,000 or 139,000 filers, and refund amount $105 million at about $750 average refund. And you can follow the table down for kind of the average filers for non-senior homeowners and senior renters, non-senior renters, and total all filers to get a feeling for how many filers and what the average refunds were for the various categories of filers. Moving on to the next table, the property tax refund program limits, and this is for refunds that are being filed now for 2011. For homeowners, maximum household income is $99,240, and the maximum refund is $2,370. In the case of renters, the property tax is equal a percentage of rent, and it's 19%, but it was reduced to 15%, and that was just in 2010, based on 2009 rent. That was the allocation cut that was made by Plenty, which saved, I think it was about $52 million was the cut, but that was just a one-time cut. But normally it's 19% is what percent of rent is used. The maximum household income for renters for refunds filed this year in 2011 will be $53,450, and maximum refund will be $1,520. I might point out that in the overview, there are two short subjects on pages 28, 29, and 30, 31 that you might want to look at and go through that have much more information on both of those, both for the homeowners and the renters for the property tax refund. Moving on to the next slide for the special property tax refund targeting. That program is one that household income is not a consideration. In that particular program, that provides relief to homeowners who have more than a 12% increase in their property tax. For returns filed in 07, which is the latest information that we have, 7.6 million refunds was paid out to 104,000 returns, to an average refund of refunds were $73.
Moving Ms. on Schill. To the next couple of slides, we'll take a look quickly at property tax burden. This is for tax year 2006 by population quintile, first for effective tax rates and then for its distribution. A quick note, the numbers for gross property tax were derived by adding together the numbers for residential local property taxes, non-residential local property taxes, and the state property tax. In 2006, homeowner property taxes, and that is after a reduction of property tax refunds, accounted for 15.3% of the total state and local tax burden on Minnesota residents. As with the property taxes in general, these are regressive even after PTR is applied, going from 4.8% for the lowest income filers to 2.2% for the highest income filers. And the next slide gives you the overall distribution on who's paying what.
Slide 39 is just an overview of the mining taxes. The mining industry pays a production tax in lieu of property tax. $79.8 million of production tax was paid in 2010, and that's based on 2009 production. The tax rate is $2.364 per taxable ton. The tax base is a three-year average production, and that tax revenue is distributed to jurisdictions in the Taconite Assistance Area based on a formula, and that is in lieu of property tax.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Baker, how does our tax rate there compare with other states that have a mining tax? Michigan comes to mind.
Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runback, I can get you some information on that. I do not have anything with me on comparison.
Okay, but I will get it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Ms. Baker? Or Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to do our very last two slides on levy limits, so you won't have to hear from us again.
I'm deeply saddened.
Levy limits have been imposed for the last 3 years. In the state of Minnesota, we've had a history of having levy limits, not having levy limits. It's gone back and forth. If you go to page 39 of the longer handout, there is actually a table that has a chronology of when levy limits have been in place since 1972. Levy limits are a limit not just on the levy. It is a limit on the combination of what a local government can raise from levy plus aids. So when we reduce the appropriation for aid programs, that automatically increases a city or county's levy authority. Levies limits apply to counties and cities, currently to counties and cities with a population of 2,500 or more. And as I said, they are now expiring. They were in place for the levies that are being certified to be paid this year. They will not be in place for the levies for paid 2012 and future years unless you as a group decide to reenact them. Under the current law, levy limits were allowed to grow by an amount equal to 3.9% for up to 3.9% for inflation and half of the growth in number of households and number of commercial and increase in tax base due to commercial and industrial property. Our levy limits in this state have not been particularly tight compared to levy limits in other states, mainly because we allow local governments to levy outside of levy limits for a number of items. Those are the major ones: debt, increases in matching state and federal grants, natural disasters, certain jail operations, pension costs. The one that is not listed here that should be is for the last several years, we have allowed them to special levy for aid losses due to cuts after the certifications. However, when they could levy for that kind of depended on the timing of when those cuts were made. If they knew about the cuts prior to January 1, they could even go in and do a levy adjustment. But if it didn't happen prior to January 1, essentially they have to levy for those reductions in the next budget year, not in the year in which the aid cut goes into effect. And with that, Mr. Chair, I believe we are done.
Well, thank you, members. And once again, I would just say to members of this committee, especially the new members, we will go with some questions here, and then we'll wrap it up. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair and presenters, thank you to Ms. Manzi for preparing this document that I asked for the other day. I'm wondering if there's a document available that shows the total amount of credits in all these various areas now under the property tax regime. And if such a document exists, if you could get it to us. If it does not, I hate to ask you to prepare one, but it
Michelle?
Might be good for us to see all of that.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, we have that document. I don't have it with me. And, in fact, I'm assuming that at some point in the future, too, we'll go over the spreadsheet, which will give you the summary of all of the tax aids and credits.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
That was
Representative
great.
Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, just listening to Representative Erickson, you know, these are tax expenditures. This is government spending. And people don't want to talk about it that way, but this is where government spends money. And, you know, you can call it a tax increase when you take it away from somebody, but it's government spending. And it's all of them, whether they're jobsies or anything on the list here or, you know, you name it. And a good way to look at all of that is in the tax expenditure book, which is, you know, about that thick, and it lists them all. And I think, you know, we've spent a lot of time on that, and people should view these rightfully as government spending. I think there's been, historically, people want to say these are tax cuts.
No,
they're spending. So I think there's ways people should think about them. But, you know, Mr. Chair, I have a question, and that was listening to the tax effective rates on property taxes. As all of the presenters were talking, you know, that's in the end. The effective rate is what you pay. And so noticing on there, you know, the highest effective rates in the property tax system is really our business community, overwhelmingly. If you look at the numbers, relative to their value, they're paying, you know, 2+ times, you know, in property taxes what their value is. And the legislature, both Republicans and Democrats, have consistently reduced that. Back with Representative Long and Rest, there was a time that we were at 5 or 6 to 1. And they brought it down, and then Governor Plenty brought it down further bipartisanly. Democrats and Republicans have continued to bring this down. And it's been a goal to try to make sure that that burden isn't so high. And in fact, you know, my take, we're hearing a lot of talk about, you know, helping businesses with jobs. The biggest tax businesses are paying is a property tax, and that's the most unfair tax they're paying. And I think, you know, we should spend some time thinking about that as we go forward and trying to think, how are we going to assist businesses in Minnesota to help create jobs? That would be one area. But I did have a question in all of this, and that is, I have some familiarity with the history of the CI rates going down to assist businesses in Minnesota. You know, since I've been here, the lowest effective rates have always been for ag, always. You know, without offending anyone in the room, I mean, the farmers get the best deal in the property tax system. Homeowners get a preferred status, but not nearly as preferred as ag. And I'm wondering, has there ever been a time that ag was not preferred in the Minnesota tax code to that, you know, that incidence level is so low? I just, historically, have we ever seen ag come close to homeowners or businesses or...
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski, as far as we know, going back to when we started and what we know from before, ag has always had the lowest classification percentage. I don't know about how, if it's been has given as big a preference as it is now, but it's certainly always been the most favored by that definition of favored class.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Lencheski.
Appreciate it.
And we thank you for that.
That's my line.
With that being said, I would encourage members to visit with House Research Staff Fiscal Analyst. We have Mr. Hines, Mr. Michael, Ms. Schill, Nina Manzi, Baker Templin, also known as the House Research Dream Team. We thank you very much, and please use them. Please use them. With that, we'll see you on Tuesday in committee. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.